I think she's getting back to you.
Something decided to pop out.
She's in D.C.
What it was.
You guys ready?
Yep.
Yeah.
Good morning, everyone. Like to bring to order the May 14th, 2015 meeting of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. We are convened. We have a couple of items this morning, Senate Bill 248 and House Bill 2049. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 248. Mr. Gallagher, can you please tell us what this bill is about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 248 authorizes the state forester to enter into and administer contracts for activities necessary or convenient for sales of timber from lands owned or managed by the State Board of Forestry or State Forestry Department, which include but are not limited to timber harvesting and sorting, transporting, gravel pit development or operation, and road construction, maintenance, or improvement.
Thank you very much. With that, I'd like to call forward, please, Brian Pugh and Ed DeBlander. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome to our committee.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brian Pugh, Acting Division Chief for the State Forest Division, the Oregon Department of Forestry. Excuse me. The division manages about 800,000 acres of forest land for the benefit of all Oregonians. The division is primarily self-funded through the sale of timber. The majority of the revenue generated is distributed to the counties, schools, and other local taxing districts. The division has been working on many fronts to increase revenue generated. This will benefit the division and, more importantly, increase revenue distributed to the beneficiaries. Primarily, we're working with the Board of Forestry to develop a new forest management plan that increases harvest levels and increases conservation outcomes on the land we manage. Additionally, we're working on modernizing our business practices to increase efficiencies and more effectively utilize our natural resources we manage. We've made many internal business improvements in the last few years. Today, we're here to get your support and approval to move forward with another important business improvement. Senate Bill 248 will improve business practices by clarifying the division's exception to the public contracting law. Our current exemption is narrow in focus and limits the ability of the division to be innovative in business. Conceptually, we want to implement a new timber sale method that allows the control of the chain of custody of our product from cutting the tree off the stump to delivering it directly to the mill. Our traditional timber sale harvest method has been successful over the last 100 years. It sells standing trees that the purchaser is required to harvest, process, and haul to their facility. This new sale method that we want to implement delivers logs directly to our mill customers. A repackaging of our product delivered more precisely to what the customer wants. This alternative method of selling trees is the industry norm now. It reduces risk and can increase expected revenue generated. This will not replace our traditional timber sale method. It will be an additional marketing tool that utilizes when values can be enhanced. I'm going to turn more to my colleague to explain some of the history, to understand how we've got here, and to discuss the mechanics of this bill.
Thanks, Brian. Chair Witt, committee members, for the record, my name is Ed DeBlander. I'm the asset manager for the Department of Forestry's State Forest Division. The current situation for ODF is that ORS 530 authorizes the state forester to enter into and administer contracts for the sale of timber from lands owned or managed by the Department of Forestry. ORS 279A exempts these contracts from public contracting laws. This exemption was established during the 1995 legislative session with the passage of Senate Bill 749. Senate Bill 749 received broad support, no opposition, and this proposed bill, Senate Bill 248, clarifies Department of Forestry's timber sale authority to include alternative methods for the sale of timber and extends this the existing exemption to include these alternative methods. Under the current method of selling timber from state forests, a single purchaser will buy standing trees in the sale area and is responsible for all project work associated with the sale. Currently, Oregon Department of Forestry includes all activities necessary or convenient for the sale of timber as part of one overarching timber sale contract. Alternatives to this approach have been identified as a way to increase revenue to both the agency and the beneficiaries. Senate Bill 248 explicitly clarifies Oregon Department of Forestry's authority to enter into and administer individual contracts separately from the sale of timber. Individual contracts include, but are not limited to, activities such as timber harvesting, sorting and transporting logs, gravel pit development and operation, and road construction, maintenance, or improvement. ODF envisions two new business practices that Senate Bill 248 will make possible. The first is selling delivered log sorts, as Brian mentioned earlier. This requires ODF to both hire a logger to harvest and deliver the log and to separately contract for the construction of the roads required to haul the timber. Currently, those activities are taken care of by our purchasers. The other business practice is this will enable us to begin contracting to construct roads for our typical stumpage sales. Road construction requirements in our current timber sales frequently delay the purchaser's ability to start harvest activities for up to a year. This can increase the purchaser's risk and can delay the flow of revenue to stakeholders and to ODF. Clarifying that the exemption from the public contracting code, including the prevailing wage exemption, applies to the individual contracts will remove our barriers to fully implementing these business practices. So in closing, I will make one last point, emphasize one last point. The work performed under these separate contracts is exactly the same as the work performed under our Department of Forestry's current timber sale contracts. The activities that are exempt under the current sales are the same as those that would occur under separate contracts. Senate Bill 248 would clarify that the exemption applies under this alternative method.
So in closing, I want to say that the division's committed to business improvements, to continual improvement that enhance our methods and more effectively manage Oregon's forest. This bill will allow us to have an additional sale, one that's more flexible to markets than our traditional method. And I thank you for your time and interest, and Ed and I are available for questions.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments for two panel members? Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, so we're going to, why would we want to take that responsibility instead of putting the responsibility back on the individual that bid the stumpage? Because I'm sure it's either a camp run or are you going to merchandise this wood? What are you going to do here? Because what you're telling me is one thing, but then you're globbing it all together in another sense. What exactly, because you're talking about delivered to the mill or the manufacturing facility, and you're talking about different grades, so where are we going to get all these people to do, and why would we want to?
It's a good question. The people, the workforce, is already in place, because typically now they work for the purchaser, and instead of working for the purchaser, they would work directly for the department, and so that would be part of it. And then the idea is it wouldn't be all to one mill, it would be to multiple mill customers. So we would merchandise the trees and try to get to the best value, so deliver to different mills that pay the highest prices. And so there is some additional risk there. The benefit there, the upside, is that we're trying to increase revenue here, and we think we can increase revenue. We had been advised by several in the timber industry that it has been successful for them. We've also gotten advice from Washington DNR. They've been doing this for about the last decade and found it successful. I do want to make clear that this would not replace our traditional timber sale. It would just be used on a case-by-case basis where we think we can get that increased revenue without increasing our risk. There is also some decrease from risk. Our current timber sale lasts for 3 years, and in that 3 years, there's a lot of things that can happen on many fronts. This method would be done in a matter of 4 to 5 or 6 months if possible, so decreasing that time frame for a timber sale decreases your risk in some ways. So it's more of a trade-off for risk than a straight increase of risk to the department.
Please.
So explain to me how you're going to increase your revenue. Is it through the merchandising part? Is that what you're going to take, like your number twos and your peelers? You're doing a 17, 10, and a 16?
That's right.
Go accordingly to a number one, number two?
That's right. It is through the merchandising. And if currently, one purchaser has to buy all the trees.
So you're doing a camp run now?
Currently, yes.
Okay.
And by buying all the trees, they have to, the purchaser buys product that they need and product that they don't want, but they have to buy it all. The product that they can't utilize, they have to off-sell to another source. And so, again, they're buying what they want and getting everything in there. In this method, they are buying just what they need and not the whole package, the whole piece of the forest, if you will.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Explain to me the inclusion of the gravel pit, the opponent of this. Why is that there, and how does that affect what Dogami's doing and other? Because we just Tuesday we had a presentation on mining and aggregates, and I would just like to have a sense of why this is part of this particular effort. Or is it? Does it supersede those programs that other mining groups are part of?
Okay, that's a good question. So to be clear, when we do these activities on the forest, there is some road construction. Oftentimes there's road construction. In that road construction, we apply gravel to the road for environmental reasons, for good quality hauling in wet conditions. The gravel pits are on the state property, and so it's part of the property. They are not commercial gravel pits. They are just used for the state property. Because they're not commercial gravel pits, they are outside the purview of the Dogami.
Thank you.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is the state going to develop these gravel pits? Is the state then going to build these roads, or is the state just going to do the contracting out for these to the private individual or to private contractor?
So the state has the expertise in the engineering, so we will do the engineering part of the development and the road building.
And yeah, the road building?
Yes, the engineering of the road building, but the actual construction, the heavy equipment moving, will be a contract, and it will be through this mechanism that we would hire a contractor, a third-party contractor, to do the actual physical development of the roads or the gravel pits.
Please.
So prior to this idea, then, has the logging company that bought the timber purchase, then prior to this, was he responsible then for building the roads to get in there to do the harvesting?
That's exactly right. We still did the engineering, but the logging purchaser was part of that. And that's the other thing that possibly decreases the value of the trees, that purchaser is required to do rock pit development, road construction, and then the harvesting of trees. And again, some of those trees are very valuable to that purchaser, and other parts of those trees they have to then turn around and sell to another purchaser.
Vice Chair McLean.
My understanding from the presentation and the questions that you've just answered is basically what you're looking for is more tools in the toolbox to have a variety of type of sales that you believe in, short-term sales that you'll have higher profits or higher margins of profit. And I'm assuming that there's been some kind of a study or some type of review to come to that conclusion. So is there anything that, you know, you have that you can talk a little bit more about as far as, you know, why you have certainty that this is really a tool that you think is not as much risk as it is to the positive side of the ledger?
Right. So we are trying to create a tool that would be more flexible for us so we can reach out to markets more dramatically. We do not have any analysis done. We do have a lot of advice from industry and from, again, Washington DNR. Our idea is that we have started a five-year pilot project to do that analysis. Okay. We have a lot to learn here, admittedly, but we also want to learn when it's effectively to use this tool. And again, we wouldn't use it on every sale, but we will analyze that.
Can I just follow?
Please.
So the pilot project's 5 years, and is it a number of sales, or is it a size, like, you know, a certain acreage?
So it's the vision there is that it will be a number of sales.
Okay.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So if you get into building these roads, I just question the ability of the state to do it for less than private contractors. And a good, for instance, was a speed limit bill that I just introduced, and the fiscal back on it was to replace the signs on the roads was $700,000. You know, some of those signs, $3,500 a piece just to replace a sign. You know, that seems exorbitant to me. And so I would think if the state was going to get into the road building business in this area, that there would be a comparison and a good study done, or that there would be a bidding process to see where the state came in versus the individual. So,
yes, Chair Witt, Representative Barreto, that's a good question, but that is, in fact, how it will be done. We will have a pool of contractors, so a pool of qualified contractors, and then when we have a road building project, they will bid in on that road building project.
Follow up.
Please.
So even on the design of the road or the engineering, though, would they be able to bid on that also?
So within the department, we have three or four engineers and to cover our 800,000 acres. So we have staff that does the engineering already. And so, no, they would not be bidding on the engineering part of it. We have been historically doing that internally.
Thank you.
Vice Chair McLean, did you have something additional?
Well, no, I was simply going to say I feel better about a pilot project, not just opening it up to using it before you really can look at the scale and see what some of the positives and the negatives are about this type of tool. And it sounds like you have a plan in place. And the reason that we're doing this particular Senate bill is because it allows you certainty about the fact that this tool is usable and that you have the actual backing to be able to try this pilot. So that's what we're actually voting on, is the opportunity to try the pilot.
That's correct.
Gentlemen, I'm reading the legislation as permissive. It does not command you to necessarily enter into these arrangements, and were the department to determine that the current method of contracting were more beneficial for whatever reason, you would be able to continue to use the current method?
That's correct.
I also, for the record, am not reading that this arrangement would have any impact on a requirement to pay prevailing wage rates. Can you tell me for certain that this would not impact that obligation to pay prevailing wage rate? I'm seeing.
Right. So as part of the exemption to the public contracting law, we are exempted from paying prevailing wage rates. We are not currently paying them now under our exemption, and under this.
That would not change.
That would not change. There would be no change there.
Okay. Thank you. Committee members, any other questions? Representative Esquivel.
Mr. Chair, wouldn't this whole project on the bottom line, on whether you've made money or not made money, wouldn't it depend upon the quality of the wood and the particular grain you're in?
That's exactly right, Representative Eskveld. And that's why we will not be using this for every sale. We have to go sale by sale and look at the characteristics of the terrain, look at the characteristics of the work involved, and look at the characteristics of the timber and be strategic of when we use this, in addition to looking at the markets. You know, is there multiple mills that want multiple products out of this timber sale?
Your answer caused me to have another question on prevailing wage rate. There are no prevailing wage rates that apply to Department of Forestry timber sales at this point?
That's correct.
And the basis for that is what? And I recognize I may be asking questions that you're not equipped to answer, and it's completely fair to tell me so.
No, we are. I'm going to let Ed, because Ed okay. knows the history a little bit more.
Well, so there, you know, it was in 1995 that the Department of Forestry, you know, originally got the exemption. I have gone back and looked at the testimony at that point in time, and it was just it was around the fact that prevailing wages was not a standard in forestry, not being used, and there was a lot of support from purchasers, industry, the counties, that it should not apply in the case of our timber sale, you know, road construction associated with our timber sales.
All right, thank you. And I presume that is something that would be different, say, if a similar gravel road was being built by Parks Department.
Chair Witt, I think that is correct.
Okay. All right, thank you very much. Vice Chair McLean.
Well, on that issue, I mean, I think the difference in my viewpoint from what I've looked at was the fact that it's private. It's a private road. It's not a public road. And it's not the same kind of standards for a logging road or, you know, that type of a road as it is with some of the other, I guess I would call systems. But I mean, if there's no difference, then I don't understand why we would have made the exception in the 90s. But it's a private road. It's a part-time temporary road that's not being used by the public. It's not a public facility.
Chair Witt, Representative McLean, so it is correct that these roads are built specifically for logging.
Yeah.
However, it is public land, and the public is allowed to use those roads and typically do, but they're not designed or built for, you know, for public use specifically.
And that road is then an asset of the state of Oregon.
Yes.
Additional questions or comments? I'm not seeing any. Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Appreciate your appearance.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to call up next, please, Bob Kirkluoto and Rex Storm. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome to our committee.
Good morning. Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'm Bob Luoto, owner of Crossing Crown.
I'm Kirk Luoto, second owner of Crossing Crown.
All right.
Okay.
Welcome.
Okay, thank you. We own and operate Crossing Crown, a small business logging company located in Carlton, Oregon. We're third, fourth generation loggers on our family business, offering services in forest harvesting, transportation, and timber marketing. We support Senate Bill 248 relating to the efficient timber sale for state forest lands. Cross and Crown has participated in the pilot test project to evaluate this concept on state forests by the Oregon Department of Forestry. We found it to be an effective way to harvest and sell timber. Senate Bill 248 would authorize a new way for the ODF to market its timber, with the objective of maximizing revenues to the state. Currently, the state sells standing timber to the single high bidder purchaser. That purchaser would then hire contractors, such as us, Cross and Crown, to complete harvest operations and deliver logs to mills designated by the purchaser. Under the current model, the contractor works for the purchasing business entity that pays for and owns the standing trees. Senate Bill 248 would modify Oregon statutes to allow the state to maintain ownership of the timber all through harvesting and trucking to the mills. The state hires contractors directly to harvest and truck, and the state markets logs to several different mills, each purchasing a specific log grade delivered by the contractors working for the state. The state owns and directs the logs until they arrive at the mill.
The industry refers to this model as log sort timber sales because the state directs sorting and selling of logs rather than the customary timber purchaser doing this. Log grades most suitable for lumber products would be sold by the state to a sawmill. The logs suited for plywood would be sold to a plywood mill. Logs qualified for utility poles would be sold to a pole plant. Pulp logs sold to a chip plant and so forth. In a log sort sale, these log grade sale arrangements and delivery destinations would be determined in advance by ODF. The state's objective is to maximize their revenue by marketing each log grade to their manufacturer where the most value can be realized. Customary in today's state timber sale, a single timber sale purchaser pays for and owns the standing timber, and that private sector purchaser does all the log marketing to optimize its revenues relative to the price it paid the state for the standing trees. Our company has experience with the proposed log sort sales, and we believe this method could improve revenue to the state in proper circumstances with oversight by the Forestry Department. Now, we would be remiss if we didn't remind the committee that the best and most efficient way for ODF to improve state forest financial performance would be to sell more timber. We believe that state forests are now an underperforming asset, because the state is not currently selling near the timber volume that these lands are growing. In fact, the Tillamook and Clatsop state forest harvest volume could be increased by up to 40 or 50% on a sustained yield basis, while protecting natural resources and its legal obligations. We encourage the committee to keep this underperformance in mind during your future deliberations of state forest asset management.
In conclusion, we support Senate Bill 248 for the following reasons. The bill would give the Forestry Department a new and useful tool in its toolbox. Two, we do not suggest a wholesale change to the log sort sales on state forests. Rather, we would support Senate Bill 248 to add another tool that helps market a portion of the state timber. Three, ODF has shown it successfully can administer forestry contracts without being encumbered by the state's complex direct contracting requirements. Four, the bill would provide harvesting contractors such as our company opportunities to work for an additional customer, ODF. Five, we believe this bill would improve state revenues received on those select timber sales where log sort transactions make sense. Senate Bill 248 would foster financial returns to counties, taxing districts, and state forest administration. We're open to take any questions at this time.
Questions, committee members? Rex?
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Witt and committee members. My name is Rex Storm. I'm a certified forester and forest policy manager for Associated Oregon Loggers, and we represent just over 1,000 member companies that are involved in forest contracting statewide, and they are involved in harvesting, reforestation, transportation, construction, forest protection, firefighting, the full gamut of forest management activities. I'm here today to support Senate Bill 248, as the bill does clarify one additional method that would be useful for the Department of Forestry in selling state forest timber sales. from state forests. This additional method referred to, as you've heard, the log sort sales, we believe could help foster improved revenue to the counties and taxing districts, as well as Department of Forestry, State Forest Administration. Our reasons for support are similar to what Bob and Kirk expressed. We believe that authorization of these log sort sales from state forests would be a market benefit to small business forest contractors. These sort sales offer more options for contractors as ODF would become one more customer, one more entity to hire contractors for their services. And we don't anticipate that this would replace the existing timber sale purchasing method. What we would see is maybe 10% or less of the state forest timber sale volume being used by this tool, maybe even 5% or less, but some small portion. Our second reason for supporting this is the state forest timber sale program has a proven track record of successful exemption from the burden of public contracting code, and we believe that those exemptions should be extended to these individual activities for log sort sales. Third reason is we believe that the state forester and their professional staff are qualified and capable to accept this new authorization for specific activities from state forest lands. Next, we do not see any conflicts or disadvantages of adding this additional tool. And lastly, while this bill could potentially make some improvements in revenue received from a small portion of state timber sales sold by the sort method, ultimately we support greater revenue generated from state forests through increased timber sale volume from state forests. So with that, I appreciate your time and urge your support of this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair McLean.
Well, when I looked at it, it looked to me like it was a tool that would help us be able to fine-tune some of the work that's done in the forest, because there's a lot of times when a timber sale happens, and as all of you've talked about, there's a person who's bought that timber and they have a particular purpose. So they get in and get that kind of lumber out, and then the rest of it feels like it takes quite a while because it may not be what they're looking for or what their specialty is. And so to me, as you speak, that 5% or whatever it is that this tool could be used on would help us with better harvesting and also better cleanup and everything else, because it would also let smaller businesses have part of the pie. But as you describe it, I mean, we have to look at the pros and cons, right? And so you said you didn't see any real necessary cons to this type of a tool, and you feel like it's been used in other places, and you've experienced that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Representative Gorsuch.
So we're talking about the potential to increase revenue. What's the estimate that we're losing right now under the current method? Does anybody know?
That would be a question more for the department to answer.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're going to, how do you determine, because when you see a tree and you start to drop a tree, you have to make your own mind up at that point whether that's going to be a number two sawmill or whether a saw log or it's going to be a 1710 number one peeler. Who does that? Is that going to be your faller, timber faller out there?
I can bring that up. It's an operational deal. What we do as contractors, we will go out. If you put it in a contract perspective, we're the general contractor. We cut the trees, we bring the trees to a landing, we process it on the landing generally. Most generally now, we have equipment, the computers that process it on the landing. We sort it on the landing, and then we send it to the mill according to the sort and the demand. So we're doing it all right there right now. That's what we do for the mills. So we will do the same thing for the state, and we have been doing the same. We're working on one currently, and we'll be working one again in October, or no, it'll be August. We'll start on another one. So we're the ones doing it. So we're doing the same thing for the state as the mills have us do for them, basically. So we're doing it.
Please. So you're bringing the whole log into the landing, and that's where you're doing your merchandising?
Most generally, unless it's too big to handle, we'll bucket into links out there. But generally, we have all the sorts.
Chairman, representative. Yeah. Well, just like my father said, we're pretty much from the stump to the mill. We have our own machines that can go out and cut it down. We have our own cutters that go out and hand fall it, just like what you said. But we will actually bring everything in, and depending on the size of the tree, the sort, the grade, we make all those determinations out there, and it's nothing that we haven't had to learn to do on these sort sales. It's everything that we currently do anyways. So we do that for private contractors as it is.
Rex, you said you had about, slightly over 1,000 members who do logging contracting?
Yes. We represent just over 1,000 member companies, and those are a variety of contractors, primarily harvesting and forest management related. But several of our members are also manufacturers as well.
Do you know how many of those operate State of Oregon sales?
State forests are roughly 700,000-800,000 acres in Oregon, and I'd venture to say about 100 companies.
100.
It changes because most contractors work for several different customers over the course of a year, two, 3 years. So.
Okay. And gentlemen, can you tell me? Do you typically operate, does Cross and Crown typically operate on a specific state forest?
Mr. Chairman, no, we operate, we're out of Carlton area, so we'll operate on any particular state forest within a two-hour area. We travel and do pretty much whatever it takes. We do a lot of state forests, but we also do a lot of private land operations, so what we do, and we also will do a lot of private forest operations, say individual landowners that own some of their own forest, and they're trying to do that. We go in and thin it. And what we'll do is we'll merchandise our own timber, and we do all the same things basically that we do for the state. So we'll do several. Well, we've got several sales now that are state forest. We have about 45 employees, so we have a, you know, we do all of it, trucking, cutting, everything. So we go wherever we need to go to get the work. I don't know if that answers your question.
How much of your business is State of Oregon?
What would you say, Kurt?
Mr. Chair, right now, like you guys said, depends on year to year, maybe 25% right now. We have two current sides working for Stimson Lumber Company. We have one side currently working on the pilot test project, and then we have a few other private, just different landowners, just small landowners, like a small woodlands association type landowner that we'll work with, and whether or not we work with a forester or we'll actually come up with the logging plan and the land management plan ourselves, we'll do that all too.
Okay. Additional questions or comments? Representative Gorsuch, please.
I would like to talk to the department again about my question.
As I would too, Representative Gorsuch. I suspect we're going to the same place.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Additional questions or comments?
You don't mind asking how old a guy he'll let fall timber for you?
How old a guy? You want to come in?
I've done it.
I know. I'm sure you have. I know.
10 years.
Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We might remind Krieger they don't use a misery whip anymore.
Would the department come back up, please? Mm-hmm. Thank you, gentlemen. Representative Gorsuch.
So this has been described as another tool for the use of the department. My question is, what is the difference in terms of the cost in doing it the current normal way, or the traditional way, we'll say, and doing it in this particular new way? How much are we losing right now, and how much would we gain, do you think?
For the record, again, I'm Brian Pugh with the Department of Forestry, Chair Witt, Representative Gorsuch. We expect the cost to be neutral. We expect the profit to be more. And so we're thinking that the cost would be about the same, but then we would get a higher value for the product.
Do we have any estimate? Oh, follow up.
Please.
Do we have any estimate of how much more profit we would get out of this?
Representative Gorse, we have, again, consulted with industry and consulted with Washington DNR. The numbers that the Washington DNR gave to us was 10 to 15% on those particular sales of increased in revenue. But that is part of the pilot project. That is what we need to study. And again, 10 to 15% on just those selected sales. And we've made it clear it's not going to be across the board on all sales that we'd use this tool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Gentlemen, do you anticipate, first of all, what percentage of your current contracts are sole source?
So our Chair Witt, our current contracts are sole purchasers. Mm-hmm. So they'd be 100%.
100%. How many bidders typically enter into a bid?
So we have approximately 100 timber sales a year. We sell approximately 220 million board feet. On any typical average, I'm thinking across all our nine districts, I would say an average sale gets 4 to 7 bids, depending on market conditions, locations, timing of the year, things like that.
4 to 7 bids on average, roughly, plus or minus. On 100, roughly, plus or minus 100 sales per year.
That's correct.
And of those 100 sales, is there the top 5 or 6 companies to win those bids would be who?
So we have some large industrial mill customers. I'm going to name some names, and I'll apologize if I leave any of them out, but Stimson Lumber, Hampton, Boise Cascade. I'm going to look to Ed for to add to that.
Oh, there's quite a few others. Chair Witt, the hardwoods go to, there's several hardwood mills. Well, I'm trying to think of some of the other names of the bigger companies. There's quite a few,
And I recognize. I mean, I couldn't name you the Seven Dwarfs either. So I recognize the problem with the question that I pose. But I'm just looking at how open a process this is, and in terms of road construction and that sort of thing, how many. The top 5, 3, 4, 5 companies, who would those be?
Right, just to follow up on the mills, because I had a minute to think about it. Of course, Roseburg Forest Products, Seneca Jones, Interfor Mill, and so there's some more. Those large purchasers are the ones that hire the logging, and they subcontract, if you will, the logging and the road construction companies. And I don't know how many there are. That might be actually a question for Rex with his members that he.
Okay. Would you provide our committee with that information?
Do you have
a chance to go back to the office?
Sure. And just to be clear, the information you're looking for is the number of road construction companies?
Of the top 5 bid winners for road construction. Would you provide us the names of those top five companies, please? When you get back to the office.
Yes, we can. Just to be clear, though, the purchases are large mills, and then they...
And then they...
Subcontract.
Sub it out.
Yeah. With the road.
And is that public information?
I'd say that's their private information that that individual company has. Hmm. And so it would be on a case-by-case basis whether that's available to the public.
Oh, would you check on that and let us know, please? Thank you very much. Additional questions, comments? Not seeing any. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Anyone else from the public to testify in Senate Bill 248? Last and final call? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 248. Committee members had this one up as a possible work session, and I think going to wait for some of the information to come in before we work that one. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2049. Mr. Gallagher, can you tell us about this bill, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2049 authorizes certain hunters to use battery-powered scoping devices, pin sight lights, and laser sighting devices to hunt, and allows person to accompany visually impaired hunter to assist with hunting activities under certain circumstances, and there is an amendment to this bill as well.
Okay. Can you tell us briefly about the amendment?
The amendment is House Bill 2049-1, and it would stipulate that that person described in House Bill 2049 would be a veteran who has a disability rating from the United States Department of Veteran Affairs, whose discharge or release from active duty was for legal blindness incurred or aggravated in the line of duty, and who possesses a visually impaired hunter license.
Thank you very much. Our colleague, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Krieger, McLean, and committee, for the record, Greg Barreto, Representative House District 58. This bill started, I think, over a year ago with Representative Bob Jensen, my predecessor, and a constituent of mine, James Rayburn, who I found out about this, but he had Bob write a bill, and that is House Bill 2049, and then resubmitted this year with some amendments. And so the original bill, as it's written, it takes out bow hunting, it takes out basically the pin dots and some of those other things, and it just deals with a battery-powered laser pointing device. And then it would require an assistant to be alongside at all times to basically tell him where this laser is pointing and high, low, right, left. I just picked up this laser this morning when my constituent came to my office and was playing with it just to see how it would work. And at 50 yards in broad daylight, I could still see this green dot, and they'll give you a demonstration of that. But I've known James for many years. He used to be a karate instructor. When I first met James, karate instructor, when my kids took karate classes, and so we've stayed in contact. He married Amanda, which I had known since she was a little girl. And so, and James lives in Cove, the same little town that I'm from. And so I do have a good connection with James, and I would really like to have him and Lance Shoemaker come up and make their case for this bill. But I did want to emphasize that the bill is changed a lot from its original form with the Dash 1 amendment. So, and if there's any questions for me.
Thank you very much. Any questions at this point? Thank you, Representative Barreto.
Thank you.
With that, what did I hear this? I'd like to call up, please, James Rayburn, Lane Shoemaker, and James Rabaun.
You think you pronounced me twice, James Rayburn.
Oh, okay. I didn't read the writing. I'm sorry. Stan Steele.
Thank you, sir.
Morning, gentlemen. Welcome to our committee.
Good morning.
Please determine among yourselves the order of your testimony.
May we use a visual aid? Chair?
Please do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Can I approach up there?
Yes, you may. Yes.
Thank you very much.
James.
For being heard. Thanks for the call.
You're entirely welcome, and thank you for your service, sir.
Don't give the device to Escobar. He'll never hit it from here.
I knew it would hold on. I just knew it.
It took you about five seconds.
That was a little delayed.
It's not the instrument. It's who's guiding you. So,
James, well, you're going to see that you. We have a number of hunters here. And
That's good. If you don't mind, can I start?
Well, Representative Krieger goes out hunting.
Does he? Good.
Are you saying he doesn't find much?
No, I walk my gun.
All right. Chairman Wynn, I'd like to thank you, like I said, personally thank you for allowing me to be heard. Everybody has handicaps. Everybody has ways of dealing with handicaps. I'm blind. The difference is I have the capability. She's humming. Am I doing something wrong?
No, sorry. Your name.
James Rayburn. Sorry, ma'am.
Thank you.
Anyway, so everybody has handicaps. The great thing about it is technology has given us the ability to function normally with those handicaps. You guys, some of you, I don't know your ages or anything, and I can't see you at all. And I'm not going to ask because I take it that goes on record.
Yes, sir, and it's as embarrassing as the inability
yes.
to... we won't talk about
that. I won't say that, yes. Having said that, some of you may use hearing aids. Some of you may use glasses. Some of you, drive here. Some of you may even have the cars that have the wonderful thing that parallel parks for you. This is all technology that aids you in your normal day life. Being blind doesn't mean I can't have a normal day life, and it doesn't mean that I can't do normal things. The Oregon statutes already have it written that someone can help me aim and help me sight and help hold the weapon, help do all this stuff, but they didn't give me the ability to do it safely. And we're lucky because now there's 18 other states, and we can't count the last one, the 18th, because they just voted it this year, but the 17 other states have over 10 years of case law from the Fish and Wildlife showing that there's been no bleed or creep from legally blind people. And I can say, we weren't going to use visually impaired because actually blind is not offending to me. Blind people hunting. Now, having said that, there's been no accidental discharges. There's been no woundings. There's been no blind people traipsing through the woods shooting at sounds. Believe it or not, all we do is we go and we sit in a stand or a predetermined spot where we know animals come through with our hunting partner. Now, as it stands now, my hunting partner, since I don't have a way of doing this as I feel safely, I have to allow my hunting partner to shoot it for me, which the regulations state they can. Now, the 17 other states have allowed lasers to be used and other electronic devices, but I found lasers is the quickest and easiest way to use. Some people aren't up to date on the laser technology. Laser technology is very, very useful. My brother and I have been able to go to the range, and at 300 yards, he can talk me onto a 6-inch target, and I can fire several shots repeatedly and not miss. It's like no other hunting, most of you hunt, you do the same thing. You go to the range beforehand and you shoot and make sure your weapon's on. You shoot and you practice, hopefully. You practice before you go hunting. And you make sure that that you're doing everything correctly, that your weapon's functioning, that your everything's okay. Be no different with me. The only difference is my partner comes with me and he practices with me and we make sure that everything's good. And then when hunting day opens up, We go sit in the blind, and if I'm lucky enough to have an animal walk in front of us that's safe to shoot, my hunting partner will tell me, we'll use the laser, and I have it right here. I'd be happy to show you. I think we have an animal on the wall, don't we?
Yes, we do.
Okay, this is Lance. He's going to work as my hunting partner. And basically, all I do is this would be attached to my weapon. And this is a very mild one, actually. There's much more powerful ones on the market. And basically, I just put the laser out here. And he's just telling me where to go.
Come up about 3 feet. A little to the right, please. A little more to the right. A little more to the right, down about a foot. A little more, a little back to the right, a little more to the right, all right, a little lower, and fire.
That's it.
He's done.
That's it. Now, this isn't new legislation. The Fish and Wildlife already has standards, and already has says what you have to do. They already have the forms. This isn't going to be a fiscal problem because every 2 years I have to go to my doctor, even though I'm permanently blind. I go to the doctor, fill the form out, send it in, and they send me back a card saying that I'm blind. So there's no changes there. The law is already there. The rules of what is and isn't visually impaired, in my case, I'm going to say blind. That way there's no people saying that, you know, I wear glasses, I'm visually impaired. We're just going to say blind, okay? Because when you read the description of what the regulations say, you're blind. That's how it is. My family has been hunting for years. I started hunting when I was 8 years old. It was one of the greatest joys I ever had. And losing that, losing everything, you know, imagine one day you wake up and you can't see anything anymore. You're that's it. You can't see. You can't, you know, you have to learn how to, you know, use the bathroom by yourself. You have to find stuff, and hopefully no one switched the toothpaste with the preparation H. You know, practical jokes, no joke. It's my kids thought it was funny. This is on record too, isn't it? Sorry. Anyway, so you got to learn to retrain your life, and you got to be upbeat about it. And this is one of the last hobbies I have is hunting.
You got the and deer.
Say again, sir.
Yeah, you got the deer. It fell off the door.
I got him. See,
yeah.
It was a good shot.
There it was.
You can't. Yeah, sorry, I got too far away from my phone. Anyway, see, it was a good shot. That also brings up also something else too. Somebody was commenting about follow-up shots in case, you know, there is chances, you know, you shoot, the animal moves, and what it is. Well, the person with me has a rifle already because he, at a distance, you know, even with a laser, you have to use an ocular device to see the laser. So he's already got a hunting rifle with his scope on it already on the animal. So if the animal doesn't go down and he sees that it was a bad shot, he already has a follow-up shot. He can take it, and it's totally legal. It's already written in the Fish and Wildlife regulations that he can shoot the animal for me. This just gives me the chance to actually be back hunting, to give me the chance to do the normal things. And it's not excessive technology. There's been all these 17 other states. No other person has been able to use this law to balance it off, to use it into something else. You can't go to your doctor and fake blind. You're blind. The law's written for blind. You can't go to your doctor and fake you have a backache. And then I know there's been state police officers. I think Mr. Steele was a state police officer, and he said it was aggravating because you see people that would get the handicapped permits, shoot from their vehicles, all this stuff, and then you see them next week cutting wood and stacking it like there's nothing wrong. Okay, you can't fake blind. You're blind. I have scar tissue. I can show pictures upon pictures of the tear in my brain, all sorts of stuff. If you want to, you know, if you wanted that proof, my doctor does that every 2 years, even though it's permanent. There is no magic laser Patriot guided bullet. So no matter where the laser go, the bullet doesn't follow. So there is no advantage to it. It's just giving me the chance of using technology to do something that I normally did in my everyday life. I think it was Mrs. Escobar, is that correct? I'm sorry, the female. I'm sorry, I'm terrible with dames.
McEwen?
Yes, ma'am, you were talking about tools in your toolboxes.
Oh, that was McLean.
Yes, Representative McLean. Straight ahead. Over here?
Right here, just a little to the left.
All right, there you go. Oh, there you go. Okay, yep. I heard you. You were talking about tools in your toolboxes to the last guys. All you're doing is allowing me another tool in my toolbox, something that is just not overly outrageous. And the beautiful thing is, like I said, there's already 17 other states with fish and wildlife studies, not NRA studies that you can say can be biased, not guns and ammo studies that are biased. This is fish and wildlife. Mm-hmm. So these are good studies. These are good things showing that blind people can still maintain and do a hobby that they did beforehand, or in some cases never had the chance to do because they were born blind. I think I've covered everything on my part of it, other than, like I said, I'm very passionate about this, and I, like I said, this is my last hobby. This is the last thing I had. So I've been fighting very hard for this. Lance has been with me, and Mr. Steele has been a good help, and I'm sorry I wasn't able to talk to most of you. Believe it or not, my iPhone, when it reads numbers, doesn't give me very good numbers a lot of the time. And I know a lot of you don't want me to get your personal numbers because I do call. You can ask Mr. Steele. I don't give up. Anyway, I'll let Lance go ahead and explain the laws. He has the paperwork actually here that Fish and Wildlife gives you. It's free. And he can explain that. He can explain other stuff, too. So what I say, do I turn over to him now or do I ask for
questions?
Yes,
and Lance, if you please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Dr. Lance Shoemaker. First and foremost, I'm James' friend and hunting partner, shooting partner. Our kids are friends, our wives are friends. That's small town America. Also, James and I are brothers in arms. We were both in the Army, different times. He saw a lot more rougher stuff than I did, but I still drag around a little bit of hardware in my left leg from about 20 years ago. So I think we're kind of a natural match for this thing. James contacted me because I'd spent 13 years working for the NRA as an election volunteer coordinator. So he knew I knew my way around the ropes a little bit. And he asked if I could contact the NRA and ask for some help. And I said, solving one person's problem is, that's admirable, but let's look at this from a legislative standpoint and see if we can't change the rules so that it affects all of the state. Let's look at the bigger picture. And he thought that was a fantastic idea. So that's how we started on this journey. I knew Representative Bob Jensen, who I have to say a very honorable man, did exactly what he told us he was going to do, which I commend him for. Honor and integrity mean more to me than just about anything. So I put the legislation together as best I could. I'm not an expert in that field, and handed it off to Bob, and he put his guys to work, and I thought they wrote a very competent bill. We had a hearing about a year ago, which we received almost no notice on, which you might imagine is a little difficult from where we are. Plus, I run a full-time practice, so I'm a little busy. We were unable to attend, unfortunately. But here we are today, neither here nor there. So, I'll talk a little bit here. I think really, on the surface, we're talking about a piece of legislation, and it pertains to hunting, and it pertains to people with disabilities. But actually what we're talking about are the concepts of freedom and liberty. Freedom is, in essence, being the state of being free. Most people understand freedom, but few people understand liberty. Liberty is the ability to do what you like as long as you don't impede upon your neighbor. That's a very important concept, and I think it's maybe one that's a little lost in today's society. We all kind of want to dominate each other's lives instead of just worrying about ourselves and minding our own lives. So I really want to stress this idea of liberty. If we go back to the 1830s, we had a visitor to this country, Alex de Tocqueville, who was a French political writer, philosopher, very learned man. And he was absolutely in love and fascinated with the United States. He wrote a couple of volumes on democracy in America. And the resounding message there, which I truly love, was he was astounded at how independent we were, how we took care of problems ourselves. He talked about France and how everything came from the monarchy, and it had to trickle down, and we had these ministers that basically had to be bribed to get anything done, and he said, not America. They handle their own problems. They have people that bind together and take care of problems in their town, and if they need to, then they go up to the next level and they ask for help there. He says it's a grass movement, it's a grassroots movement from the ground up as opposed from the top down. He was absolutely fascinated with that, and I think that's kind of where we're headed today. We're asking you to give us the ability to take care of ourselves, to go out and enjoy these things ourselves. Once again, that concept of liberty. So if we go and we look, let's go back a little bit in history. Let's go to a place in Germany called the Neander Valley. And most people kind of know the word Neander, and they think, oh yeah, those Neanderthals, those guys that were kind of hunched over. Actually, they had a larger skull than we did, which seems odd, but very strong. They claim that they're extinct. I don't know. I wrestled in high school. I'm not sure I didn't encounter a couple of them. I think Greg wrestled, too. He could account for that, too.
I was one of them.
Yeah. But anyway, the Neander Valley is a fascinating place. It has beautiful rock formations and was well known for that before there were skeletons discovered. These Neanderthals had some interesting features. Several of the skeletons they've found have physical problems, malformed. One appears to have had an amputated arm. What that tells us from an anthropological standpoint is that they found value in the individual. It wasn't simply dog-eat-dog. And these people were considered to be cavemen, basically, compared to us, you know, Homo sapiens. So one of the underpinnings of modern civilized society is taking care of those that can't take care of themselves, to look out for those that have less than we do. And here we have Neanderthals that are capable of looking after those and found value in those people that had less physical attributes. So here I sit next to a man who is every bit my equal and maybe my superior in many ways, but I have one attribute he does not have, and that is sight. And that's a very, very valuable tool. But once again, we're pretty sharp-thinking people. We have all these wonderful technological advances. So being that we do value every citizen in our society and find strength in that value, we have taken steps to make sure that we've taken care of those folks. And that's why some very wise people in the past have done things like write law into our fish and game regulations that allow people with disabilities to hunt. For instance, I hold my hand, which, what was the color it used to be?
It used to be blue.
Blue. Now it is beige. When I called for the blue form, they said now it is beige. I picked this up from the Northeastern office, regional office yesterday. This is the application, and one has to fill out, have his physician fill out, stating that he is legally blind or has any other disability. Just to show you, it is here. It is strictly defined who is legally blind. It has nothing to do with whether you have glasses on or off, whether the sun is shining or not, whether it's a legal definition. You have to go to a licensed eye doctor and you have to get this filled out. There's no way around it. But just to show you, it does exist. It's right here. There'll be no additional, there's no impact, as has been stated in the bill. And I also brought a copy of the big game hunting regs with the section on what is a disabled hunter and what counts as legal blindness. I also happen to use this one to mark my pick for the bull elk tag that I'm sure I'll get. 253X. So just to show you that it is here. So a little bit of the nuts and bolts of this bill. Like I said, not my brainchild. Really, it was James' brainchild and other people's brainchild because it already existed. When I started delving into this, I'd remembered an article I'd read in American Hunter where a young fella had gone and taken his first deer. And they were sitting in the stand, and of course he was nervous as all get up, and his brother was with him, and he walked him in on the animal, and he shot this deer. And I remember reading it, thinking to myself, this guy is having the exact same emotions that I have every time I shoot an animal. There's a lovely story about a 13-year-old girl that is blind. I believe she was born blind. She went on her first deer hunt. And I tell you, I'm sure it was me at 13. I felt the exact same thing, the same excitement when I shot my first bird, except a little more challenging for her. And at first, I'll tell you, it was quite a foreign concept. I was like, that is the strangest thing I've ever heard. And then as I chewed on it a little bit more, I thought, you know, this is neat. I like this. This is great. We're just allowing someone to participate in either an event they've done all their life or getting to join our ranks. And those of you that hunt know what a special experience that is, particularly that first animal. That is, that's an experience you can't create anywhere else. And every time you get to hunt, and hunting is more than just shooting the animal, obviously. But without having the ability to kill an animal, it's truly not a hunt. It's a photographic safari or a walk in the woods or something like that. But it's not the same. It is not the same. So, you know, as James touched on, there are other aids to hunting. It's funny. I've been in the field an awful lot, and I have yet to see a hunter riding a mule from his house out to the field. Almost everyone comes in a vehicle. That would be an aid to hunting. I've seen people riding four-wheelers. That would be an aid to hunting. The very weapons we use are an aid to hunting. Let's get more basic than that. Glasses, hearing aids. How about a pacemaker? Those things are all an aid to hunting because without them, you wouldn't be there. That's all there is to it. How about the guy's wearing a brace on his knee? It almost gets to be a little ludicrous when we think about all the things that make our lives easier every day. How about the fact that you were able to go to the store and buy some food so you could eat something while you're out in the field? That is an aid to hunting. These are all basic aids to hunting. They're just part of civilization. So what we are asking for here is nothing more than just the ability to do what you're capable of doing every day. All we're asking is a little bit of consideration for James' service, and outside of the service, how about a little consideration for another human being who just seems to have one little bit of disability? As James said, we all have disabilities. I drag this left leg of mine around, and quite often I put a brace on it. If I had to walk to the woods, I probably wouldn't be hunting. I wouldn't make her too far. So anyway, in closing, I'd like to thank you for your time. I know we're all busy. I thank you for your service. Lord, I wouldn't want to do this job. I know it requires a great deal of sacrifice, and I know each and every one of you is a patriot or you wouldn't be here. And to me, that means a great deal. It means a great deal to James and myself. Like I said, we both served in the Army. We both have our souvenirs, internal, and that's just part of the price we pay. So once again, would really appreciate some serious consideration here in letting James just be one of the crowd. Thank you for your time.
Get that out of your head. That's fine. Chair Witt, committee members, my name is Stan Steele, representing the Oregon Outdoor Council, but more importantly today, just representing an Oregon hunter, probably even the perspective of a former Fish and Wildlife Enforcement officer. The important thing that James and others have brought up through this conversation is the inclusiveness, the compassion, and our sports are compassionate sports. Conservation is a compassion. And there's really no reason to have boundaries or barriers to who we allow in. Techniques are a different deal. We do have to have some boundaries on our techniques. The interesting thing is the North American model of conservation is absolutely bound by a code of ethics, code of conduct. For those of us who have served, and I'm sure there's others up there on the panel, I know some of you have, we were bound by a code of conduct. And that code of conduct is really a code of ethics. But what are ethics? Ethics are determined by personal human values. We set those. Those aren't something that others set. We set ethics. And ethics in hunting is called fair chase. So what really is fair chase? To some hunters, if you're a traditional archer, You only want longbows. Compound bows are unethical. If you're a fly fisherman, terminal bait gear is unethical. If you are a traditional muzzleloader and you just want a cap and ball, you look at an inline and you say that's unethical. So these are standards that are societal standards. And what's great about the North American model? It's a democratic rule of law. It's access to and use of wildlife to be best managed through those laws. So what's great about what James is trying to pursue here, and what Representative Jensen and Representative Barreto now has followed so honorably followed through on, is designing those standards. That's what we're here today talking about. I, for one, checked thousands, if not tens of thousands, of harvested creatures in Oregon. Probably tens of thousands. And when those were honorably harvested, the glee, the satisfaction was just incredible. I had a disabled hunter who I personally knew, school teacher at Crescent Valley High School, Dale Martin, passed away this last year. He used my back for a rest. Dale was a quadriplegic. He had very little use of anything other than just his hands, just a few fingers. Dale draws a Alsa unit cow elk tag. I'm on all fours. I was the bench rest. I almost get tearful over it because we did all have tears. And I can remember a 12-year-old girl. I'm out on patrol on the Lambert River. And I see a boat parked along a gravel bar, and I pull in with the Oregon State Police sled boat. And a father and daughter are out hunting. She's 12. It's her first hunting experience. And we talk. He says, gosh, we haven't seen a deer or anything all morning. And I said, why don't you stand down at the end of this swale? And I'm going to go up, and I'm going to break sticks and beat rocks and do everything. And I'm going to come through that brush patch. And hopefully there's something in there for her. And I go up, rush through the brush, crash, smash, make all the noises that you want on a drive. And I hear, bang. And I'm thinking, well, hopefully she was successful. But even if not, she was, because she had the opportunity. She was, a little forked horn by Spike Buck. I'm not sure who was prouder, Dad, the child, or the game cop. We actually got to provide what is a basic human need, and that's connect with nature. This young man served multiple tours of duty to protect that democratic rule of law. Why we're able to sit here today and discuss whether laser sights are a reasonable use, very narrowly applied, is because of what these people have done for centuries in our country by defending those rights. So I do agree with the last gentleman that says this is more than just about hunting. This is about our liberty and our rule of law. But the standards under the Seven Sisters of the North American Model of Conservation don't say that traditional archery is better than conventional archery. They don't say that centerbore rifles are better than others. They're saying that we will allow principles, three principles. Hunting when it does not have a negative biological impact, and the herds and the quarry or the focus species will always remain sustainable through our activities. And let me go to the other two principles. And this is the technique to be used fair and acceptable? Now, this technique that we're talking about is going to be assigned to extremely narrow focus. And for those folks, if you were to ask them, it's extremely fair and acceptable, because if they don't have it, they're not the shooter. They're just the tagger. In other words, somebody else is doing the killing. This allows this person, whoever it may be, to actually be what's so important to all of us, the actual participant. Not the observer, not the purchaser of the licensor, license, but the actual harvester. That's what drives us all as hunters. That premortal, getting back to our ancestral, whatever it may be. It's very spiritual. And then, does the take and use of the focal species have a legitimate purpose? Well, we feed the physical, and we feed the soul. That's the spirituality of hunting. Millions of people have tried to put that into words and have been unable to do it, and it'll never be obtainable, because you really can't define that spirituality, because it's individual. So my request, and why the Oregon Outdoor Council accepted this responsibility of coming in and working hard to ensure that we had at least an informational, and hopefully in the future, far more than that, is it's a societal goal to take care of ourselves and others who cannot, and especially those who have sacrificed so much so that we can take care of ourselves. So in closing, there's nothing wrong with this. This isn't unethical. You're going to hear that it is, that my gosh, this is the camel's nose under the tent. Well, maybe turning on the ignition to that Ford four-wheel drive pickup on opening morning to get to your hunting stand is a camel nose under the tent then. We're going to simply be allowing people to participate in something that we all hopefully want to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Can I answer? That's my name again.
Yes, please. If you would, that sure helps clarify the record, and I really appreciate your attentiveness to that. Thank you.
Sure. James Rayburn. Can I answer any questions? I wanted to dispel any doubts of thinking that this is dangerous in any way or anything. Is there any way I can explain something that would help you understand that this is no different than apparently Representative Krieger going out and hunting with his rifle, if he hunts with a rifle? I don't know what you hunt with. Is he over here on the side?
Yeah, yes. I'm right here.
Okay. It's no different. You're checking your backstop. You're doing all that stuff. It's a safe environment, all that type of stuff. The only difference is I'm relying on my hunting partner who's right next to me to do that for me. I don't feel like a piece of luggage that's just being brought along for someone to tag that animal. And that's really what it feels like, is that you're thrown in the vehicle, you're taken somewhere, and then someone shoots it, and then they come up and say, okay, you tag it. And this year was a huge example of that. I drew a big bull tag. The rest of the family didn't draw anything. One of my friends, we went to the normal hunting spot where we always hunt. And my friend, he used my rifle and my ammunition that my son and I loaded. He took it out, sighted everything in for himself. So yeah, but he used my rifle. He kept me involved as best he could. And he shot a 270 class bull at 125 yards. The bull was closer, but we had to wait until legal shooting hours before we were able to shoot it. The whole community showed up. By the time we were done, there was over 40 people there from the city of Cove helping. In fact, I wanted to skin the animal because I was tagging it, and they made me get out of the way because they were worried about me cutting other people's fingers. The FedEx guy stopped and took the heart. This isn't like a small thing. In my community, hunting is a very important thing, and I just can't stress how much that how narrowly this is constricted, and with all the prior state's laws that show everything. It's just hard for me to see how there'd be a negative to this. You're helping not only disabled people, you're helping a veteran. So I mean, you got positive there. There's no negative. So please, would you ask me questions as to why you would have disagreements?
Thank you for that offer, and I personally do have a great many disagreements with this, and I'll be very candid, oppose it vehemently. With that said, committee members, questions or comments? Vice Chair Krieger.
You know, I had your position originally back in, was it 13? We had the bill. If you look at these amendments, and we've talked about the amendments, but you've got to understand the meaning of the amendments. The meaning of the amendments mean that this creep we were concerned about, or cheating that we were concerned about, isn't going to take place. It's very restrictive. The second thing is you got to go back and look at the original statutes, which allows now lash to shoot his deer or elk for him. I don't see the difference by allowing him to use this device. And then I get back to, and this is kind of a sidelight, but Lance, you mentioned Alexis de Tocqueville. Born in 1803 in France, came here, homeschooled, spent 2 years running around the country looking what we did, and wrote it. By the way, if you haven't read it, I've got it in my office. I can support the bill.
Additional questions or comments? Vice Chair McLean.
Well, I simply wanted to thank all three of you for your testimony today, and I really appreciate your openness and your willingness to help us experience what you're talking about and experience what this would do and help do for your life and for life of folks that have shared your circumstances. So I just want to tell you that I was listening intently and that I was really moved by your testimony. So thank you very much.
Yeah. Anyone else?
Could I add one small thing?
Please do.
Okay. Lance Shoemaker.
The one thing I did want to, I meant to mention, and I apologize for that, the laser ensures that we're on target. We sight it in ahead of time, and that makes sure that we're taking a completely ethical shot, as you can see as I walked him in there. So the concerns with, you know, I understand when you first hear this, it's kind of a, whoa, how can that be? But this laser puts us right on the spot. We know exactly where that bullet's going to hit. So there's no chance of any problems there. Like I said, I'm backing him up. I do my job. If we need a quick follow-up shot, it's a done deal. So I just want to be very clear about that. That's the benefit. The laser is working like his eyes. Me and the laser together, we've created new eyes for James. Until someday when they do create new eyes for James.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
That's all. Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. And James, I recognize that you and I had talked earlier, and I recognize that your blindness is due to a service-connected disability.
Yes, sir.
A very horrific incident, and thank you, sir, for your service.
Well, thank you for letting me, like I said, you were to your word. You called and you talked to me like you said you would, and you told me you'd let me be heard, so I'm thankful for that.
And we're thankful for persons like yourself and for Dr. Shoemaker, who readily provides service to this country. But as Mr. Steele said, it is a democracy, and part of that is disagreement. And I would like to share with you some of the disagreement that I have, and I would like to offer an alternative perspective to some of what you've presented here. I have been a hunter since I was a little kid, and accompany my grandfather, accompany neighbors. So I have been involved in the hunting and shooting sports for a very long time. And one of the first things that I was ever taught, and one of the things that when I had to go through my hunter safety course, was the Ten Commandments of Gun Safety. I don't know which number it was, probably about number three, to make sure of your backstop. And gentlemen, I do not deny in the very least bit that with the sighted hunter accompanying you, that is the sighted hunter's obligation. But let me share with you a very recent anecdote that occurred to me and my son about assuring backstops, assuring, making assurance of your target. Because of the fantastic hospitality of Vice Chair Krieger and his wife, my son and I went turkey hunting on their ranch, and by the way, they've got an excellent turkey raisin ranch. You have never seen anything like it in all your life. At the very last, my son had an opportunity to shoot a turkey, and it, literally at the last instant, there were two toms, and one tom stepped right behind him, and he couldn't shoot. And he came literally within a hair's breadth of pulling the trigger. He would have shot two turkeys. It would have been, it was a virtual certainty had he pulled that trigger. Mm-hmm. And it happened in an instant, that, you know, a fraction of an instant, that that second bird ran in behind the other one. I'm suggesting that it's not limited to turkey hunting. I personally have experienced, I almost pulled the trigger once, and I had another deer that just materialized behind the first one. There is not the slightest bit of doubt in my mind, zero, zip, none, had I pulled that trigger, that I would have shot two deer. It was an instantaneous appearance. Mm-hmm. That's my concern about the backstop.
Can I comment?
Please do.
James Rayburn. You're right, that, and you have eyes. The same thing with my thing is Lance, I don't pull the trigger until he says pull the trigger.
That's correct.
I follow all the safety commandments, too, of hunter safety. In fact, I probably have a better knowledge of weapons than most people do and how to use them. Until he says fire, I don't fire. And it's his job to make sure that there isn't a second animal anywhere close, and in the areas we hunt, that would be that way. Like you stated, though, sighted people make mistakes. There's been sighted people. In fact, there's been people that make mistakes all the time that have eyes that make mistakes. I'm not saying that mistakes aren't going to happen, but what I can say is in the 17 other states, there hasn't been any mistakes.
Well, and James, I don't dispute that in the least. And I think that sighted people make mistakes all the time. The purpose of my anecdotes was to suggest to you that the opportunity for mistakes is increased when the person who pulls the trigger isn't sighted. I, at one point, was sitting literally shoulder to shoulder with my son. I could have told him to shoot, and had I, and that other tom ran in right behind him, there wasn't time. There was not. That was a split second decision. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to. I don't want to belabor this point, but there are other concerns that I have, as people who have to make public policy. Mm-hmm. We have to make public policy in part based on we have to protect that species. And I'm not sure that we are providing that protection that's necessary were this to move forward. I'm also remain unconvinced that we provide that element of protection for the public in allowing blind hunters to be hunting. Now, you can say, well, we have that right now. I agree with you completely. Do not dispute that in the least. But I think the more that we increase the opportunity for accidents to happen, we have shortchanged the public. And you may come back and say, well, actually, Representative, we've diminished that opportunity. We now have a laser. What I am suggesting to you is we have an absolute obligation as far as protecting the public safety to diminish to the greatest extent possible the possibility of an accident.
I understand that. James Rayburn.
Thank you.
I understand that. I definitely see your point. As I'm, I've stated, the areas that we hunt in are so thoroughly staked out. I mean, it's wide open fields. There is no chance, we have solid backstops. You don't take a chance, like I said, unless you have a perfect shot. Unless it's, that comes back to the hunter. You said the tom ran out from somewhere. The tom, that tom turkey had to be there somewhere. Otherwise, your son wouldn't have seen it run in there.
That's right.
So what we, as responsible hunters, do is make sure that in my circumstances and other blind circumstances that are stated in the other 17 states, is that the animal that is harvested is completely safe. That the animal isn't next to anything, that there's no more animals running near it or near it or anything. And like I said, I think that is a point that, can be argued back and forth. I think we go all day back and forth on that. I agree that you have a purpose that you have to try to make things safe as possible. And if that's the case, then there shouldn't be any hunting, because then you.
Well, and what, we could.
We go. Where do you draw the line? Is what I mean is we already have the statute that's already written that says that someone can hold my weapon and help me guide my weapon onto the target, but you didn't give me the tools to do it safely.
And James, oftentimes drawing the line is one of. There may be politics that are involved as well, and our life is one of politics virtually on a daily basis. And sometimes politics is a matter of perception.
Mm-hmm.
And I would suggest strongly that we've got a perception problem. Were I to walk out on this street right now on the sidewalk and ask the first 10 people that came by how comfortable they would be with allowing blind hunters to be pulling triggers. Now, whether I agree with it, whether I disagree with it, I'm merely suggesting to you that there's a perception problem here.
I understand that. James Rayburn, as it is right now, you'd have to tell those public that you already allow it, but that you don't allow us the use of the proper tools to do it.
And so, I would only suggest that the perception problem may get even worse with the introduction of lasers.
James Rayburn again. Yes. That's why the laser, I think, would be better for the perception, is because we've shown that it's a safer way of doing it. That we've proven to the public that it is a safe and I'm trying to think of a responsible way of doing it versus the way it's written now, other than maybe in luggage, which I won't accept.
Nor should you. But I would also suggest that part of the problem that we have with diminished numbers of hunters participating in our sport is a perception problem as well. And while that may or may not be of a concern, what really concerns me is an adverse public image of hunting to begin with. Vice Chair McLean.
I don't know if I have anything to add. I'm just having an emotional reaction to this hearing this morning. I really agree with our chair that we do have to worry about perception as far as what the public thinks we're doing and what we are doing, because sometimes it's hard or it's difficult. People looking at me wouldn't believe I came from a hunting family or that I had the opportunity to hunt pheasants or that I did target shooting until I was 23. And so, I understand what you're talking about as far as the culture. And I do think that what the chair had to say was we have to deal with not just what it really does, but what the public thinks it does. Mm-hmm. And so I personally feel like you have advanced this issue today, that you have brought to us realistic comments and ideas and thoughts, and that you've advanced your purpose for coming here today, because you had this committee really listening to you. You had this committee really talking with you about what are some of the issues that we have in making new law, mm-hmm. or improving law, or trying to bring realistic, safe, you know, issues to areas like hunting. Mm-hmm. And I think we're still listening. Well, so I understand that this is a process and that we're still listening, but we don't have just the simple issue of having folks understand the specific issue. And most of these people up here hunt all the time, right? They're out here hunting on weekends. So, I mean, I think they really get your story.
Right.
But it's the fact of how do you carry that story into revision of law or to make the circumstance that you're hoping for. And I think we're still listening. So that's all I've got to add.
Sure. I'm James Rayburn. I'm happy to keep talking and explaining. I've never quit. It's been 7 years, and I'm it's taken 7 years to get here to be listened to, and I'll keep going. So just tell me what you want next, and I'll be happy to do it. You know, what else can I do for you?
I'm a new, Matt, Mr. Chair.
Yes,
I am a new legislature, and if I knew that, I would tell you and get that help. But right now, I'm still trying to figure out the process as well, and try to figure out, you know, what are the steps that we need when we really have some energy or some passion for something that we would like to see changed.
Okay.
But I thank you, and I think it's just staying in contact.
Okay. Rep James Rayburn, representing Krieger, can I ask a question of you?
Yeah.
What do you think I should do now?
Probably what you've always done. You need to press forward, continue to work. I'm convinced. I don't know how many people here are convinced.
Representative Witt, may I make
yes.
a statement?
Please.
You know, as a young fella growing up, our society moved from this model of keeping those with disabilities in institutions in a way. For instance, I think we're all familiar with places like Fairview. And we decided to integrate those folks with problems into our society. If you'd asked me as a young man if I'd have seen a man without any legs running a sprint, I would have said that's impossible. Yet we see that today, and actually some of those sprinters are faster than the ones with legs. They're certainly faster than me. If you'd asked me if I'd have seen a man without legs driving a car in the 50s, I'd have said that's impossible, but we see that every day. And if I'd have brought that to public opinion, and I'd have said, hey, what do you think of this guy over here, Jim? He doesn't have any legs. What do you think about me throwing him in the car there? People would go, oh my goodness, what will happen? Yet we see paraplegics driving all the time. So I understand the difficulties with public perception. I understand that you are politicians and elected officials, but sometimes we have to make bold stands and just simply do what is right.
Dr. Shoemaker, what area of practice do you practice in?
Well, as you can tell by my logical presentation, I have to be a chiropractor.
You have to be a chiropractor. Well,
James Rayburn, Representative Witt, is there any way I could take you hunting, or you could take, I could go with you and show you and convince you that
I'd be happy, James, to go hunting with you. I'd be happy to do that. It would be an honor.
Okay. I'll have an elk tag this year. I'll draw a second season tag no matter what.
Okay.
All right. And as a veteran, one of the great things is I get to shoot a cow or a spike. So where we hunt at is exclusive farmland.
Well, hunt the canyon, make him pack it out.
No. The whole community shows up. It'll be a great fair. But second season, I'll have the tag. Come and watch and see where we actually hunt at and see what we're talking about, and see the community's response and like I said, I'll expect you. In fact, I'll put you up in my house. My wife will feed you.
His children will torture you.
I'd like to dispel the, like I said, help you maybe build a public opinion that you could give to your constituents. Excuse me,
thank you.
Mouth's a little bit dry.
Thank you.
I want to change your perception because in my mind, I know it can be done.
Well, and there's no doubt in my mind that it can be done, but it's one of guarding the public's concerns to the greatest extent possible, and I think I have an absolute obligation to that.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Shoemaker, I know you mentioned changing public perceptions, and I don't want you to think that we're guided by wetting our finger and sticking it up in the air currents, because that may be a part of it, but it's certainly not what drives me to make a decision. And I'm a little hard pressed on the spot to think of the perfect example, but I think we might allow for the fact that there may be certain people in the medical practice, maybe a surgeon who is blind, and we wouldn't necessarily or appropriately, I would suggest, expect that that person would be conducting a surgery. And so there are limitations that do accompany the disability by virtue of the disability. And sometimes there are limits that, as society, we don't expect to exceed those.
Sure.
And that's all that I'm suggesting.
All right. Understood. James Rayburn?
That's why we have technology. As it advances, mm-hmm. that surgeon, maybe, with the technology, would be able to be a surgeon again. What I'm saying now is we have that technology already.
And I,
not for the surgeon, but for this.
And again, James, that technology has not eliminated my concerns at this point. But gentlemen, I certainly appreciate your testimony very much. I recognize that the both of you have traveled a very long distance to get here to make this possible, and we are very grateful for that. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
With that, I'd like to call up, please, Al Elkins and Rich Thompson.
You were right here.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Very good.
And Mr. Krieger,
you're right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And ma'am,
you're right here. I'm here. Thank you. You have a good trip back.
You're very well. Talk to you later.
Come on over here.
Remember, we stayed in Cove?
Yes, we did. Yes, we did.
Brad.
Good morning, gentlemen.
You morning. Got your
morning.
Jerky, your son shot them both.
Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome.
For the record, I'm Al Elkins with the Oregon Hunters Association. I know we're limited on time. OHA has 10,000 members, and when we have issues like this, and we have similar discussions that you've had this morning here, I have a prepared statement of why we're opposed to the bill, but I don't think I need to get into that other than to say that we have concerns about high tech advancing into hunting and the concept of fair chase. We had members come to us when drones first appeared on the internet and asked us to push legislation. We've done that. We've been before the commission on crossbow issues. People, our members, not wanting to allow crossbows in hunting. And I can remember when we got into muzzle loaders and the types of shots that they were using. Our members wanted to keep it as traditional as we possibly could. So this is not about the disability. This is about technology for us. And we've always been opposed to allowing technology, for whatever reason, into the hunting arena. And we have, before the commission, drawn a line in the sand and said, we don't want you to go any further than you already have in relation to technology. And that's where our board is in relation to technology and hunting and this bill.
It's about the tech. It's not about the disability. Ironically, when I first started with this group, the first bill that I lobbied for was the language that we're talking about amending, the hunter disability language, the blind hunter. We supported that. We supported it in both chambers, and it was the first bill I testified on in relation to the Oregon Hunters Association stand. Yes. So we've worked with the disabled and work groups with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. We've helped them any way we can to get a full experience of hunting and for them to have that opportunity. What we have not done is allowed for technology at any level for any group of people, and that's where we are in relation to this bill. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you. Let's let both of you testify here before we open it up.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is Rich Thompson, Newburgh, Oregon, representing the Traditional Archers of Oregon. Just very briefly, ditto everything Al said, basically. It is not about the technology, it is about the technology. It's not about the disabilities. And one of the comments that I heard was who we let into hunting. We don't have a problem with that. It is about the technology and where that is taking us as hunters. You'll see in the testimony I did prepare down the bottom, there's a bold-faced type that says TAO suggests that technology is becoming a substitute for traditional hunting skills. And we're seeing that every place we go. There are new gadgets and gizmos that come out every day that if the Fish and Wildlife Commission allowed, if the legal system allowed, would be made legal. There's people out there that realize there's money to be made from having all these gadgets. And we're just getting to the point where a lot of states in the United States don't have the resources to support this technological advances. So there are some other concerns that I had listed in my prepared testimony that concerned me, but there was also some new revisions to the bill that I was not privy to prior to the meeting today. So I guess in a nutshell, that's where Traditional Archers Oregon stands on this. And I do agree, Chair Witt, with your comments and concerns about the general public. If I might say, Mr. Rayborn and his system seems pretty well dialed. I was very, very impressed with the safety concerns that were brought forward by Mr. Rayborn and his associates. But I understand your concern. Is everybody going to be as conscientious as that team? I'll leave you with that.
Thank you very, very, very much. Vice Chair Krieger.
I'll get on you two a little bit. You took all the technology away from the archers that they've got hanging on a bow today. It would be ridiculous. And range finders, you've got Oregon Hunter Association members shooting elk at 700 to 1,000 yards. And tell me how sporty and ethical that is. You've got 999 members, not me.
Okay.
May I?
Please.
Traditional Archers of Oregon has come up with what kind of hunting weapons should be legal in a traditional hunting area, of which there are two in the state of Oregon, Canyon Creek and the Trout Creek Mountains.
Uh-huh.
That compromises wooden-handled bows without any more accessories than a quiver.
Uh-huh.
That is wooden arrows with feather fletch, no carbon arrows, nothing that you can attach a sight to the bow readily. So we do recognize, and I'm sorry, I know Chair Krieger has a thing with this, and I do appreciate his concerns.
As do a number of us. Thank you. Additional questions or comments? Rich, are there other states that allow laser range finders on bows? Do you know?
Absolutely, sir. Chair Witt, absolutely. Most states probably do allow those. And we have a company right here in Oregon, hiring Oregon people, Leupold and Stevens. I worked there, actually, for 2 years. They have a very nice range finder, but sorry, you know, if you want to use it, hang it around your neck or put it in your pocket and pull it out and use it. But when it's on the bow, that's just draws the line. The rule is no electronics on bow or arrow. That's a perfectly good enforceable law from a state police standpoint, in our opinion.
Very good. Al, other states, you mentioned muzzle loaders. Other states allow putting a scope on a muzzle loader?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Al Elkins, Oregon Hunters Association, I don't have that answer directly. I do remember when we were looking at the muzzle loader scope issue that other states did say they had them, but I, that was second or third hand to me. I don't know that.
Are you aware of other states allowing Pyrodex cakes to charge the muzzle loader?
I have been. Mr. Chair, we have been told that that is the case, but I'm getting that second and third hand. I've never asked that question to anybody in other states. I do remember the issue that I thought was funny at the time when RoboDucks allowed for automatic decoys, that brought I think Stan and I were talking this morning. I think we're one of three states that's not allow those, but that was a huge issue for our membership, was the automated decoy, duck decoy. So we've been involved in a lot of what I call high tech issues.
So these items that we've just discussed, the fact that other states allow them, should Oregon adopt it?
Chair Witt, other states have a deer problem, opposite, totally 180 out from Oregon's deer problem. They've got too many, and they want dead deer. And I think that should be pointed out, and that's why they allow people to take four deer a year, and we're lucky to get a tag for one.
Okay. That came up too, Mr. Chair, during the crossbow discussions, allowing crossbows. We talked to the commission about abundance of wildlife, the lack of here in Oregon. Crossbow users wanted to establish a completely different season, and the bow hunters and traditional archers and ourselves just didn't think we had the abundance to allow for that. So that has come up in other discussions.
Thank you. Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So see if you can clarify this for me. It's not so for both of you gentlemen, it's a question of technological creep into a traditional sport. Is that correct?
That's yes. For us, it is yes.
And even though this bill would appear to be solely crafted for a very, very small number of people, you would still worry that it might be then applied in broader circumstances. Is that the opposition?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coase, that is our concern. It's that proverbial nose of the camel camel under the tent that we're concerned about. I have read the amendments. I do not know what the impact of those amendments will be. I just saw them this morning, but I will work with Representative Barreto to find out what the impact of those amendments are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question, Al. Rangefinders was brought up. Does your hunting group agree with rangefinders, either hanging around your neck, in the scope, or in binoculars?
Representative Witt, Representative Barreto, I'll have to get back to you on that. I don't know that for a fact. I've never been in discussions with the board in terms of rangefinders, but I will be with them this weekend, and I'll get that information to you.
Thank you.
And just for clarification, laser rangefinders on bows is not allowed in Oregon?
Chair Witt, no, sir. We like the rules as it stands, no electronics on bow or arrow.
All right.
We don't want our seasons to get down to 5 days like rifle seasons, quite frankly.
Very good, sir. With that, we've run out of time. Gentlemen, thank you for your testimony. Thank you, everyone, for your patience. We are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you. We are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you. Patience.